Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, Big Interview listeners. I'm Neil White, and from Backpage, this is the first in a brand new series that you'll find on this channel during the summer, Revista de la Copa Mundial. We're going to be walking through Spain's World Cup win in South Africa 10 years ago, looking at the tournament in general, but our focus will be on the eventual winners. The reason for that is that I'm joined by someone who was with them, and these are not my words, dear listener, these are the words of Gerard Piqué, every step of the way. Graham Hunter, good morning.
Yeah, what did they used to say in South Africa? I think it was Ayoba, Ayobi, or something like that. Or better still, sharp, sharp. That's what they'd say to you, sharp, sharp.
Some of you may have read Graham's fantastic book on the three tournaments that Spain won in a row, the 2 Euros and this World Cup that we'll be talking about over the next month and a bit. I wonder if it's useful for you to explain to the listeners why you had the access that you had to this team, not just at the World Cup that we're talking about, but at all of these tournaments, and in fact, every international tournament since then.
It's all thanks to a person I despise, and I'll name him. His name's Borja Bilbao. And during 2008, he was a kind of media officer for Spain. And in 2008, I had been assigned by UEFA to be a reporter with the Spain team, but a reporter who would do not only interviews and match reports and daily. It was the first time I was aware of something called tweets. But I would also have access to a camera crew. And I remember back in 2008 in Neustift, fixing up with Paloma, the press officer of Spain, and Cesc Fabregas that we should have a one-on-one with Cesc, which even then was still pretty valuable. And it was outside the main press tent called a carpa in Spanish. And even though this was the Austrian summer of 2008, pretty grim, I've written before that we were up to our knees in mud in the surrounds of the training ground all the time. There were ticks, which could give you syphilitis if you weren't inoculated. And of course, Sergio Garcia, the player, Santi Cazorla and I think we're only three people there not inoculated. And there was a guy, this media officer, Borja Bilbao, was a stroppy, irresponsible, bumptious git. And he reckoned that the camera crew I was using he didn't like. So he barged into the middle of our setup with Cesc Fabregas, with the player standing there ready to be interviewed with crowds of fans about 50 metres away, maybe less, and caused a big fuss and a row. And the camera crew complained to Cesc, said, look, I can't stand around in what's about to be rain waiting for this to sort itself out. So off he went with us to interview. And Borja Bilbao was removed from the camp. And the Spanish FA said, well, geez, we need a media officer now. We need somebody to step in. And from HQ in Vienna, I got the phone call, look, would you mind? And from that moment, I was pegged to the Spain team all the way to the final of that tournament. 2 years on from that rather bumpy introduction, I was chosen to be Spain's FIFA television TV producer, which meant that you got sent out to South Africa, a couple of days training in Johannesburg, and then onwards to Potchefstroom, which is a university town about an hour and a half interior, so let's say slightly south west of Joburg. And the tasks, Neil, were to basically literally go every step of the way with them, in that we myself, my camera, my cameraman, and a sort of fixer, gopher, assistant cameraman, driver, would fly with the Spain team, lug our gear on to planes. Going to matches is one thing. Coming back from late night matches when you can't miss a beat, that was our task, to make sure that we weren't the ones slowing down the process of getting through the airport or getting approval from the cops or getting the flight to take off. So flying with them, living with them in their team hotels prior to matches, but also being within a 5-minute drive of the training camp, and every single day that we were allowed to, filming training, filming interviews, doing special promos with the players individually or with the staff. And therefore, as far as being integrated with a team goes, I don't think, even in subsequent tournaments, I've ever been as close to being cheek by jowl with the Spanish FA expedition. And I mean by that the coach, the directors, the press staff, the marketing staff, the players, the physios, the kit men. Our access, the level of trust was high, the level of responsibility was really high. But I look back on it now, even if you haven't yet talked about the ultimate triumph, I look back on it now as one of the most intense, one of the most enjoyable, happiest periods of my working life.
Yeah, I should say that the book I mentioned before was produced by Martin and I at Backpage. We also work on these podcasts with Graham. So when we were working on that book, it was my privilege, and it was also, to my great surprise, like hearing these stories firsthand from Graham. And realizing, as a former football journalist, the proximity that existed between you and a team that were already European champions. You know, they were already at the absolute top of their game. A lot of them were European champions at club level as well by this point. I mean, we're going to get there. Graham ends up in the winning changing room after a World Cup final. But that's just a really fantastic illustration of a proximity that really stretched, as you've just described, over the 50 days that the team were together. So we're going to be tracking this tournament, Spain's progress through this tournament, in real time, more or less. So all that's coming up today. As a little lead-in, a little teaser, we're going to stop and focus on the player who's going to become the poster boy for this tournament. The guy at whose feet the ball is going to land in the dying moments of the World Cup final and produce a moment that it's hard to forget, even 10 years on.
Spanish are outnumbered in the Netherlands half, but they still kept the ball with Iniesta. Now Torres. Iniesta's in the middle. Torres is trying to find him. It's broken for Fabregas. Now it's Iniesta. This is it. That's the goal. Spain have surely won the World Cup.
So that's Andres Iniesta, the goal that won the World Cup for Spain. Graham, you and I have talked about that goal, this guy, I don't know how often in the years since, but just recently you've started to talk to me about this period in his life in a completely different way. And it's odd because I've always thought that you already knew everything about Spain and about Iniesta. Turns out it wasn't the case.
Probably the best way to begin is to go back. It's impossible to overstate how hurt Iniesta was by Rijkaard leaving him out of the starting lineup for the 2006 Champions League final in the Stade de France Saint-Denis. It's not in Paris. Xavi ultimately says if Iniesta hadn't come on at halftime, we were going to lose to the 10 men of Arsenal. We weren't going to win. Van Bommelen and Milson are chosen in front of Iniesta. Iniesta has always said there are players who started that game who weren't as good as me, in as good form as me, who hadn't behaved as well as me, and I should have started. He's never pointed out, but there are really only two candidates. He comes on in that game, they win. He comes on and he's special, and irrespective of Belletti and Eto'o getting the goals and the brilliant impact Henrik Larsson has, it's Iniesta's match, and by a distance. But that is no balm, Neil. It's no salve to the, not just fury or anger that he felt, but it nagged him. It nagged him so much that by the time the 2008-09 season is finishing and they've won the cup against Athletic Bilbao at Mestalla in a gigantic performance, having been 1-0 down, and then just torn strips off Athletic, They've beaten Madrid 6-2 in a match that they have to win in order to just keep Los Blancos away from snapping at their heels. Thanks to Iniesta's goal at Stamford Bridge, they've made it to the Champions League final. And therefore, although not everything is about the treble at that stage, because they still have to tuck away the league, which they're focused on, there is a treble beckoning. And what's more, there's for Iniesta, who again breaks the mould here, because he is your ultimate club man, team man. Yet he's obsessed. He's utterly obsessed by making sure he's fit to start against Manchester United in Rome. And yet against Villarreal, and the weirdness of this is that against Villarreal in his final league game that season, he completes the 90 minutes. Now, somebody got it wrong, because during the end stage of that game, when he could have come off, he's done so much damage to his right thigh muscle that there's a 2-centimetre tear. Now, I don't know if you can just use your fingers now to mark out 2 centimetres and then touch that to your thigh or your calf and think, what would happen to me if I had a 2-centimetre tear? It's destructive beyond belief. Now, Iniesta has decided, without any possibility of being dissuaded, that he will play in Rome, that he will heal until the morning of the game. He'll take an injection and he'll play under any circumstances. Now, his recuperation with Emily Ricart, the club physio brought in by Pep Guardiola, is tremendous, but he reaches Rome well and take the ball, Thierry Henry, and I interviewed Thierry Henry last week again, and we spoke about it again, and he said that to this day he's still unclear how he played or how Iniesta played. Thierry Henry told me that he lied about the state of his fitness in order to play. And Iniesta, people now know that the wide figure that's put about what nick he was in, that he was only 60% fit. It's known that Emily Ricart said to him, if you shoot off your right foot, your right thigh will snap, it will ping. You won't be able to walk off the pitch. So he doesn't shoot, but he wins a loose ball off a Michael Carrick header, runs a third of the pitch, sets up Eto for the opening goal after 9 minutes, and after the match, Alex Ferguson said, we were beaten at 1-0. We were beaten at 1-0. After the match, Wayne Rooney walks into the Manchester United dressing room and said, we've been beaten by the best player in the world. And he names Iniesta. Yet the cost then is just utterly off the scale. The damage he's done to that right thigh is so great that he won't really be properly fit again until the World Cup the following summer. The second enormous thing that's happened is that a combination of what a psychologist who we'll talk a lot about, Ima Puch, says is like postnatal depression. Some people, in her view as a sports psychologist, she says, suffer after achieving greatness, after pushing themselves beyond where they thought they were able to in order to achieve a goal, a wave of, well, what's this worth? Or what's next? Or who am I really? Hits you. Some people it bounces off. Some people it never comes to. Some people it affects to a degree that they can cope with. And some people it devastates. Iniesta was one of those that was devastated, because the combination of his physical debilitation allied to the fact that he was hit by a wave of what must be called depression, irrespective of triumph, meant that he came apart, not just as a sportsman, but as a human being. So I think you began this by saying to me, you know, that he's the iconic figure and the ball will drop to him. Yeah, fine. But we are talking about a man who, in all honesty, probably shouldn't have made it to the World Cup. That's number one of the astonishing things that are about to happen.
You're talking about all this taking place before we get into an incredible personal loss that takes place in the pre-season of the following season. That's the pre-season of 09-10, the World Cup season. This is purely, this has been isolated by the psychologist to refer to this feeling of, I thought this was everything I wanted, so why aren't I happy now?
Yeah, but also, that is exactly right. If we paint an accurate picture of the guy who's going to score the greatest goal in La Roja's history, we have to, not for dramatic purposes, we have to put layer on top of layer. Because the moment when he lifts his jersey, spoiler, when he scores the winning goal in the World Cup final, and it's Danny Harkey always with us, is written there. Danny Harkey was a Catalan born in Barcelona, Andrés Iniesta is not, but they were very similar ages. They played together in a youth team. And if you've read the book about Spain and their treble triumph, I make a big deal of how, for example, the iconic friendship between Real Madrid's Iker Casillas and Barcelona's Xavi Hernandez, which was a fundamental saviour to La Roja through difficult times, that there was hands across the divide, friendship across the divide, that happened. Cesc and Sergio Ramos, for example. Danny Harkin and Iniesta were the same. They were Barca and they were Espanyol, the two sides in the city of Barcelona. They played together in the winning European under-19 championship side of 2002. They lived closely enough together that they often gave each other lifts to either events or sometimes to training. They were close. They were really tight friends. So it hits in the 8th of August, Espanyol, Raúl Tomudo, the iconic modern-day scorer for Espanyol, has left. He's no longer captain. Harkey's made captain literally when they come back to training. So he's been captain for, I don't know, about a month. And they're in Florence. They're about to play a friendly against Bologna. They've trained with no ill effects. He's on the phone to his wife in his hotel room. And his system shuts down and he dies. And sudden death in footballers is something that the medical authorities have become better and better at preventing, predicting, coping with the things that cause it. It came out of the blue for this fit, healthy, elegant, handsome leader. And the impact is all for the Harkey family and for those teammates around him who saw him come in off training and shower and go to his room and never come out again. But it hits Iniesta, a close friend, really badly. And I've talked to him about where he's talked about his destiny against me, or is there a greater force doing this to me? Now, depression causes you to think in strange ways and say strange things, but it wasn't a selfish sense of loss. It was devastation. When his physique is failing and his mind is weak and Danny Harkey dies, this becomes a typhoon. During this, what Spain calls a state of alarm, Iniesta and some of the journalists he's most friendly with whom he wrote his, not autobiography, but a book that's where he participates in what effectively becomes a biography of his career, comes out as a film called The Unexpected Hero, El Héroe Inesperado. I was startled because we hear his mother and father talking about this illness that Iniesta has for the first time. They talk about during the summer holidays where he's won the very thing that he was desperate to achieve, a starting Champions League final. He's got the trophy, he's got the medal. And during that summer, before Danny Harkey dies, Andrés Iniesta begins to disintegrate. Doesn't want to eat, isn't happy, goes to bed early, locks himself away quite a lot, is morose and patently unhappy. And as the injuries begin during the season and his mental state continues to go downhill, the thing that knocked my socks off, his parents are living with him and he's courting the woman that Anna will eventually become his wife. And there's a night when Andrés Iniesta, and it's hard to say out loud, but he comes down and says to his parents that he needs to get into their bed for the comfort of being in bed with his parents when he's aged, I don't know, 26 or 27 or whatever it is. And they say to him, son, what? And he said, I'm not well. Now, at a time when in sport we're asking footballers to speak out, to find somebody to confide in, not to commit suicide, not to hide these this darkness away and put on a front. I think it's still right now extremely brave of Iniesta and his parents to speak about this. There are, you know, in the film, it's a greater spotlight on the dark corners of what was going on, because we all knew that there was a serious problem, but how serious, I wasn't aware. How debilitating, and the degree to which people around him were lost. I think as well it's really important to touch on the fact that there's a psychologist involved here called Emma Pooch. The club said to him, you must go and see Emma Pooch. And she talks about him at first saying, I'm lost. I don't know what's wrong with me. I've lost all faith in myself. My game is gone. And he says, can you put me back as I was? And she said, no. By the end of this, you'll be better. You'll be a better player and you'll be a better person. And they start on the process and she helps. It changes. But at the same, this is where I think this is an epic, epic human story. During the process of Emma Pooch, psychologist, trying to put his mind together, his body keeps failing him. I think the 13th of April, they're training. And while Spain and the World Cup is very, very, very much on Iniesta's mind because he thinks he's not going to get there, Barcelona really are in a position where they probably could and should be winning a second treble. They get knocked out of the cup too early because they slip a little bit. Can they still win league and Champions League? Yes, they can. Should they have? Yes, they should have. And Inter at this time are a rising force, coached by Mourinho, brilliant, one of the brilliant periods of summer transfer has in the modern history of football, which took place in the summer of 2009, with Mourinho largely the architect rather than the club behind it all, has made their squad and their side very, very good indeed. Iniesta's trying to be fit for the game against Inter Milan, and in a training drill, which is a simple ball out to the wing, cross ball in, finish somehow, as he comes in to finish, his thigh gives way again, and there's footage of him just trotting past the goal a little bit, stopping. You can see the realisation in his mind of what's happening. He walks about six paces to the chain link fence at Barca's training ground, leans on it as if you were being searched by a cop, so feet planted, leaning slightly forward, hands up high, and he's just fucking sobbing. It's the image of a man who thinks I'm beaten. He's broken. And on that day, nobody can speak to him. And he's, on that day, he's given up. And the countdown, if you set a clock, if you were really a brutal end-em-all reality TV producer, and you just put a clock on that image, and you'd say, from that day, the 13th, there's a month and 10 days until Spain's World Cup squad leaves the country to go to the training camp in Austria. So an irrevocable deadline, no, but pretty damn close to it. And Iniesta at that stage has had a problem which has been dogging him since May the previous year, which is repeated twice, which will allow him to play 4 minutes of football the rest of that season. He thinks he's cooked, Neil. He thinks he's cooked and he's not going to South Africa.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
When you say that after this shooting drill, he plays 4 minutes of what's left of Barcelona's season, you're talking about 9 games. So he misses almost all of the only 9 games that are left before those players go into World Cup mode. In the book that you wrote, Spain, the Inside Story of La Roja's Historic Treble, you've got a direct quote from Iniesta, and it goes like this. I'd managed to create, let's say, an image of Andrés Iniesta, who played at quite a good level, and the fact that I suddenly couldn't perform like that really overshadowed my life. I got to the stage where I no longer had confidence in myself. I'd lost certainty that I could still do the things I'd always done. It was very tough. I'm pretty sure people outside the club didn't realise how bad it got. And for our purposes here, it's that last sentence that I'm really interested in. I'm pretty sure people outside the club didn't realise how bad it got. And at this point, we're not just talking about Iniesta. We're talking about Del Bosque as well. He's the one now with the responsibility. Iniesta's Iniesta. He's going to try and make it back if he can. Or he's going to try and give Del Bosque a decision. But that's all he can do.
In the midst of this blizzard of what Iniesta feels is divine intervention against him, the two lights at the end of the tunnel turn out to be, well, in terms of the people that he relies on to give him space and time, are Guardiola and Del Bosque. In that Del Bosque, Neil, as you rightly point out, he desperately wants Iniesta ready. He doesn't know he's going to win in the World Cup, but it's clear that on form, Iniesta is one of the top 4 or 5 players in the world at that stage. So the great thing, as I'd already pointed out, is that Guardiola, on a daily basis, gives Iniesta enormous space to rediscover himself and is enormously patient. And at a time when, as you pointed out, Guardiola desperately needed Iniesta back to play against Jose Mourinho's Inter, which didn't happen. He didn't play in either of the semi-final ties. But Del Bosque, first of all, is hugely patient and then takes a risk. Now, why did he take the risk? Not just on ability. Spain's doctors, Saladas and Cota, don't have access to Iniesta at all. They have to go through the club, and the club are giving him, you know, a pretty pessimistic picture. He might heal in time for the flight to Austria, but these are repetitive injuries. He doesn't seem to be able to supersede them, and it's still hurting him psychologically. So when they report back to Del Bosque, Del Bosque is sitting at a distance thinking, well, at what point does my faith or my patience or my optimism, what point do they run out? So it's of great benefit to Iniesta, and it's a key part of our story, Neil, that Iniesta doesn't have a coach who says, okay, I have to cut my losses. There are alternatives.
Okay, so if you will allow me a slight indulgence.
I know where you're going here.
What are the alternatives? Because as great and as deep a squad as Spain have, the particular riches lie in the midfield area. And I'm just intrigued to know if you know who the first phone call might have been to had Barcelona's doctors and the Spain doctors and Del Bosque and Iniesta decided that it just wasn't going to happen.
Well, it's really, really clear evidence, because in the year which has led up to the Confederations Cup, which is held in South Africa, then the Confederations Cup, Marcos Senna has remained really important to Del Bosque. And during that club season, albeit that Senna is due to turn 34 just after the World Cup final of 2010, at 33, he's managed to play, well, let's count them. He played 30 league games, he played in the Europa League 5 times, a couple of Copa del Rey. He's touching on 40 games, age 33. Now, you can say cup half full, cup half empty. Should a 33-year-old therefore be tired if Iniesta hasn't made it, whether it be for physical reasons, psychological reasons, or Del Bosque running out of patience and optimism? Senna is a proven winner, in my humble opinion. probably he was Spain's player of the tournament in 2008, although the technical panel gave it to Xavi, and I'm never going to argue about Xavi winning an award. But Senna, to me, probably was Spain's most important player, I felt. Story behind his character, his attitude, is enormous, and therefore he's a really good candidate to go. Maybe one thing, Neil, is that he hadn't been scoring as many as usual from midfield for Villarreal. And he, in essence, in theory, is a pivote, which they've got in Busquets, which they've got in Alonso. And not for this episode, but coming up, there's a big debate about how many pivotes they need in a team, never mind in a bloody squad. So I think you're already crying tears into your vanilla ice cream right now, because had you been counselling Del Bosque, you might have been saying, get Marcus on the plane, right? Get Marcus on that plane.
I felt hard for Marco Senna in the summer of 2008 as somebody who hadn't seen much of him before then. It was kind of like a where have you been all my life moment. Agree, for me, the player of the tournament as Spain won that one. But you're telling me he wouldn't have been call number one.
I think there's another guy right across, two pegs away from him in the Madrigal changing room, who is the guy who missed out when Iniesta went, because poor old Santi Cazorla, is his litany of injury woes really begins here. Now, it doesn't threaten his mobility and his career until he's at Arsenal, but he has a hernia problem during the season at Villarreal, which means that he's only started 16 games. He's played 24 times. At the end of the season, in the last game before Spain's flight takes off for the training camp and friendlies in Austria, Cazorla scores twice. He's got just back to the peak of form, about 2 or 3 weeks too late to oust somebody else from the squad, say Javi Martinez, for example, maybe Juan Mata. But what I think adds really persuasive evidence is that since Del Bosque's taken over from El Sabio de Hortaleza, the wise man of Hortaleza, Luis Aragonés, if you look at the friendlies played in, well, first of all, in the Confederation Cup of 2009 in South Africa as preparation for the World Cup, Cazorla plays five times. During the Euro qualification, which will take place after the World Cup, which he doesn't go to, he plays, you know, five times in 2010-11 in qualifying. In friendlies in 2010, he plays three times. Cazorla isn't just the go-to man if Iniesta isn't fit for the World Cup. Cazorla plays all the games on either side of that World Cup. Yet, because he's had a little bit of a struggle with a hernia problem, because he hasn't started all that many games, and because Iniesta is fit, Del Bosque opts for a clutch of uncapped players, takes them, and both Senna and Cazorla are left behind. But if, given their experience, given that they are both Euro winners from 2 years previously, and given that at that stage, what is Santi would have been 25 at that stage, goal scorer, a regular away from tackles, he's the guy who probably most resembles Iniesta in that squad. David Silva apart, he's the one, Neil. He's the one who doesn't go and who must have been broken up.
Yeah, I mean, it's really important, I think, to look at how Del Bosque uses Iniesta later on, because generally he's not sitting next to Xavi as he often was then for Barcelona, not always.
Correct.
But he's further forward in the front three, not the midfield three.
Spot on. Yeah, which adds to the argument about you don't play Senna there, and if you've got a double pivote in Busquets and Alonso, which is what you're referring to, poor old Marcus, when I've interviewed him about this, he still feels, we've talked about this twice now, once over drinks and once in an interview situation, and he feels hurt, he feels badly hurt, he feels that Aragonés showed a faith in him that the media never had, and they won the tournament, and he feels that Del Bosque, when it came to it, just lacked a bit of faith. Now, maybe Del Bosque thought, winter in South Africa, muddy pitches, a long, hard campaign if we win it, a guy about to turn 34, that puts me off. But I think you've nailed it. in his mind's eye, if he believed that the midfield was going to be Busquets, Alonso and Xavi from the beginning, and that Silva and Iniesta might play wide of a striker, and it wasn't going to be Senna, it was going to be Cazorla, who could have played that role if you wanted to. Iniesta doesn't make it, he's broken mentally or physically, he doesn't go. Can Cazorla play wide left like Iniesta did? Yes he can. So he was the main victim.
Interesting. I mean, we'll start to not talk about Iniesta if we keep on going down this track, but I'm looking at that squad now, and as you mentioned, he's got Javi Martinez in the squad, who is your kind of backup to the backup, pivote perhaps, and you've also got Juan Mata, who is the guy that could play in the wide position in the front three, or push in the midfield as well. So I guess those are the guys that Cazorla and Marco Senna in the end would have had their eye on, saying, you know, really, Del Bosque? You know, those guys over me?
Spot on. He opts for youth and athleticism in the backup posts in the squad, where, yeah, he's like, well, not only can Javi Martinez play centre-half and midfield, does he get goals, does he defend corners and score from corners, not only can Mata play up front, false nine, either position wide, he could play as a top of a diamond in a midfield foot. These things come into your mind, flexibility. Pedro as well, I don't think has had a cap. Now, I think he went for youth athleticism. I think for a guy who's viewed as being traditional, across the rest of the squad, even though he's counting on Iniesta being on the flight, he said, I want guys who can run through the mud. I want guys who can, at the end of a season, run past tired opposition. And it didn't come to it in the case of Mata or Javi Martinez, but Pedro's another story and one we'll come back to.
Okay, but guess what? Iniesta makes the plane. He is far from 100% at this point, sort of mentally or physically, but he's on the plane, and there is an artifact that played a big part in the stuff that you wrote about this tournament in the book. And do you want to tell us about the DVD that, and I guess in 2010 it would have been a physical DVD that Iniesta was sliding into a MacBook or something on that flight?
It was, you're right. I've seen a copy of the homemade sort of Hewlett Packard printer cover for the CD and not the DVD. Effectively, Emilio Ricart is this holistic physical trainer who was involved in Iniesta's recuperation between the Villarreal 3-3 draw and the Rome Champions League final. They've become extremely close, their friends. He's currently working with Iniesta in Kobe in Japan. That's how close they are. But you led into this section by talking about the fact that he understood that while Iniesta was rickety physically, there is no way that he was fully ready for the training camp, and there was a risk involved physically, but at minimum was a calculated risk. And we have to take into account the fact that, thanks to Imapuch, there are semblances of the real Iniesta, that gritty determination that gets him to play in Rome when he probably shouldn't have gone to Rome. He should have been at home taking physio, never mind on the pitch. Some of that determination is back, but what Emily Ricart sees is that there's a guy who's still lacking in belief. So when Valdes and Iniesta are sitting next to each other on the plane, this time not to Austria, but eventually, once that adventure, and it is an adventure in Austria, has taken place, where, you know, Iniesta gets injured again against Poland and is now a real threat that he goes to South Africa but doesn't make the first group game, which is against Switzerland. Ricart sends him off with this DVD, and the DVD is Phoenix from the Flames. And in each instance, what is shown is, first of all, a guy who's now known to people in Britain, Manel Estiarte, who was a water polo god in Spain, is still widely considered to be amongst the candidates to be the greatest water polo player there has ever been. In the book, I compare him to Messi, and that's fair. So he's a Catalan, a proud, hard guy. In sports terms, he's one of the hardest men I've come across. And in Barcelona's Olympics of 92, he leads the Spain side. He's a Catalan in his home city, and they're 9 seconds away from the goal. They lose a goal. They lose to Italy in extra time. Disaster. Estiarte is iconically pictured there, weeping, destroyed, humiliated, feeling embarrassed. And 4 years later, in the Coca-Cola Olympics of Atlanta, he leads Spain to gold. And that resurrection image is followed by Fernando Alonso, okay, Asturian, unlike Iniesta, a Madrid fan, but crashing, I think, in the Brazil Grand Prix at Interlagos and crashing spectacularly. But the images fade to him driving fastest laps and winning the world title as the youngest driver at that stage ever to win it. Resurrection, again, coming back from appalling circumstances. And finally, I think there are epic clashes between Nadal, again, Madridista, which, to be fair, Iniesta once was. I'm laughing because he's a Barca icon at the stage. He's watching the DVD. But he was when he was a kid, he was a Madridista because of Michael Laudrup. But it's Nadal crushing Federer and then Federer coming back to win again. And the youngest to Grand Slam across all the titles. It's resurrection. And then there's the shot of Iniesta. The last images on the DVD are shots of Iniesta struggling, breaking down. And then there's the shot of him filling Petr Cech's top left-hand corner at Stamford Bridge to put the club through to the Champions League final of 2009. And then the trophy lift with Iniesta lifting it. It's a motivational video, which now when you describe it, is pretty black and white, pretty simple. But Iniesta wasn't used to watching things like that. And he has attributed that for giving him an I can do this feeling as he flew to South Africa. And when he speaks about it and he emphasises it being as the last thread of his recuperation, an injection of vitamin C, belief, the C being C for confidence, on its own, it would have done nothing. Applied as the final ointment, it was vital.
Okay, so that plane is now on its descent to South Africa. Graham Hunter, are you on board? Are you actually on that plane, or did you hook up with him later?
They're not that stupid. Why would you curse a flight like that with me causing... I mean, this isn't the moment. If I had to tell you about my flight to Brazil for that World Cup, boy, that was Animal House brought large. No, the team fly out on an Iberia spacious airliner, and they touch down in Joburg and get a bus to Poch. And in that time, I'm in Johannesburg. We're being trained in how do you edit the material you get, how do you code it so that we can find it with all the millions of images that will come rushing towards the central HQ in Joburg during a 6-week World Cup. We're being taught things about security. We're being told things about protocol for how to deal with the team. I'm meeting the shadow, our driver, and Miami, my brilliant cameraman, Adam, from Melbourne. And we're setting off to Potchefstroom in a people carrier packed full of massive equipment, which will be a pain in the arse to haul around South Africa on trains, planes and automobiles, but which we need in order to be able to film in a newsy way, to film in a training reportage way, and to film interviews beautifully lensed, to make feature content. We need this massive tonnage of equipment to haul around with us. And while we are not far of catching up with the Spain team, and we arrive in Poch maybe several hours before them, and we film them coming in, and we get there and we film the fact that the local ANC mayor has spent thousands of what is it in South Africa, rand, extending the military airstrip so that they can Spain can land at Potchefstroom instead of Johannesburg if they wish to, while we're in Potchefstroom ahead of time to find out that the training pitch that they've built specially was nearly washed away completely in flash floods in the late spring, and they had to sandbag the Moy River, the beautiful river as it's called there, in order to stop it washing away the seedling pitch, which they've laid specially. All these things have been going on in Potchefstroom before Spain arrive. We get there a little bit ahead of them, do some filming, and they pitch up in Poch. But was I on the flight in? Sadly not. But I still stick to my conviction that that was a really good thing for Spain.
In that case, you will see these players in Potchefstroom. We'll see you guys in Potchefstroom for next week's show, which is week one proper of the 2010 World Cup. Looking on the fixture list, we have got Spain, the reigning European champions, versus Switzerland. That shouldn't be any problem at all for this multi-talented Spain team. So it might not be...
Walkover.
Yeah, walkover.
Yeah.
Maybe not. Maybe trouble for diminutive Spain in the land of the giants. We'll see. Okay, for now, thank you very much for listening to this first episode of this trek back through the 2010 World Cup, 10 years on. And Graham Hunter, who was there first time around, thanks for doing it all again.
Shop, shop.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.